This session from the Adelaide Festival of Ideas 2011 was recorded by Radio Adelaide through the support of the Bar Smith Library, University of Adelaide, the University of South Australia Library and Flinders University Library.
I'd like to start off by acknowledging that today we're meeting on the traditional country of the Kaurna people, and we recognise and respect their cultural heritage, beliefs and relationships with the beautiful land that is the Kaurna people. And we acknowledge that these lands are of continuing importance to the Kaurna people living today, and I particularly like to pay respects to their elders past and present. Our format today is that Thomas is going to speak for about 30, 35 minutes, and then there'll be a chance for you to ask questions. We would ask you to address all your questions through the microphone because the session is being recorded for radio. I hope everyone's got their mobile phones switched off, and you are most welcome to tweet at Ideas Adelaide, and the hashtag is #AFOI, #AFOI. So that's great. So without any further ado, I will introduce Thomas. He's an Australian Research Council Future Fellow in both the College of Medicine, Biology, Environment and the College of Law at the ANU, the Australian National University. He's directed a number of research projects. He's published numerous publications on public health law and medical professional regulation, and his future fellowship is investigating nanotechnology in global health. And he's currently one of the organisers of Towards Global Artificial Photosynthesis Conference, which I noticed from his website is going to happen at Lord Howe Island later in... Oh, it happened in August, so he might tell us about that. So please join me in welcoming Thomas. Thank you.
Well, thanks very much for this opportunity to talk to you. So this is a sort of nuts and bolts talk about some ways in which we might be able to restructure certain components of our health system to deal with the problems that are being created by corporations, supranational corporations in particular, yes. Well, now, this talk sort of fits with a more theoretical talk which I gave yesterday, so... In a sense, it's really not possible to sort of get into the depth of this talk without a brief understanding of that. So what I plan to do is, in a couple of minutes, summarise the talk I gave yesterday, and that'll sort of set the scene for some examples by which corporations have involved themselves in the Australian health system in problematic ways in recent times, and then to suggest some ways that we can get out of that. So that's the sort of structure of the talk. So yesterday, essentially, I was developing these ideas that I'm putting into a book I'm just doing with Edward Elgar, that the patterns of symmetry and harmony underlying reality that are being developed through in physics in areas such as cosmology, but also quantum physics, string theory and so forth, in some ways also manifest themselves in our social relations through attempts to create ideal societies, to shape normative systems like international human rights law. This search for ideals, search for patterns, in some ways also characterises the impulse behind religions and ethics. And I think we're moving into a period of time when essentially we'll have a more physics-based approach to these areas. And one way in which we get in touch with these patterns of harmony is through our conscience. And the motivation that that provides to see ourselves as part of a sort of wave function rather than a particle, which, as we know from physics, is something that simultaneously characterises the existence of photons but also atoms and also us. Now, that's the sort of context in which we start to think about corporations. So if I've said that essentially what we're finding in society now is that in things like the Arab Spring, the Occupy Wall Street movement, the WikiLeaks, all sorts of other areas, there's been this upsurgence of conscience where people have looked at social structures and said, these don't cohere with values that I have. And when you say, where do those values come from? And they say, well, they're sort of an intrinsic part of reality. You might say, well, those values come from international human rights law, they may come from religion. But essentially, if you break down those systems, what you're saying is that what I'm looking at in relation to these social relations doesn't seem to be coherent with some underlying reality that I feel is more beautiful and more symmetric, and so consequently I rebel against these structures or I want to change them and so forth. And this is how human beings, live human beings, respond to these situations, and we see this impulse all around us, and it's getting more prominent as we have increased technological capacity to interact with each other through the internet and so forth. Now, amongst us there are people who don't respond. And who are these people? They are artificial people. They are the corporations. Right? They're staffed by real people, but according to the law, corporations are people. They, in some jurisdictions, such as the United States, they can sue for defamation. And the US Supreme Court has recently, in a decision, said, yes, corporations can sue for defamation. If you look at some of the rights that these artificial people have, and their proponents advocate, you'll see that they very often say that things like intellectual property is a right of a corporation, in the same way that freedom of speech, freedom of association, respect for human dignity, the prohibition on arbitrary taking of life, are all regarded as natural human rights, that are somehow inherent in the order of things, that gradually, as a result of interacting with each other, seem to be a pattern of symmetrical or harmonious relationships between human beings that we want to manifest. And so these corporations say that, well, our capacity to hold intellectual property is a natural right like that. And people like myself reject that and say, no, that's not. It's just an artificial construct that you guys have created because you're very greedy. Now, when you say that, you think, oh, that's a glib statement and it's so unfair and corporations are so many good ones and, you know, you're bashing corporations. Well, the reason you say that is that if you trace back the motive force of these artificial people, it's to maximise shareholder profit. So if you look at their constitution, if you look at the Corporations Act in Australia, which sets up these corporations, that's their primary purpose, to maximise shareholder profit. Now, if you're a shareholder, that's good. But if you're not a shareholder, or you're only a minority shareholder or something, you start to feel, well, is this what a person would do? Imagine if any of you in this room were somehow programmed by your DNA to only maximise profit. You'd be a very narcissistic individual. In fact, there's a film called The Corporation, which some of you may have seen, which does a psychology profile on the corporation and comes up with this conclusion that they're very narcissistic, egotistic individuals. Now, that's okay. We have lots of those people in society. They go into all sorts of... and they do useful things. We see them in politics, and for example, and some of them are useful. and that's fine. And in a sense, it's the way I'm increasingly characterising it, these are point people. In the same way you've got waves and particles, these are people who've decided to be points. Egotistical people have decided that they just want to be located in a particular space and time. They're a self-replicating molecule. They just want to maximise their own self-interest. That's what I want to do, and that's fine. And you need that. It's like saying, if you understand electricity, you can't say, well, I like the negative pole, but I really don't like the positive pole. Let's get rid of the positive pole. You don't have the electrical current. You've got to have the negative and positive pole. You've got to have conservative and progressive. And if we have both parties being conservative, then you're going to have a progressive party which comes along, you know, to actually get the energy going in society. You've got to have light and dark And essentially, so the fact that you've got these corporations with a certain amount of egotism isn't of in itself a bad thing. But what starts to cause a problem is when they have excessive influence over areas of public policy that are really important, like health. And so with that sort of general introduction, I'd now like to give you some examples from my research experience of areas where I think, some of these may open your eyes to areas that you wouldn't have otherwise thought. These sort of corporations may be influencing our system, and some of you may know about these examples, but they're designed to be illustrative, to give you an idea of the way in which these corporations are affecting all sorts of tiers and areas of our society. One of my first research projects was to look at the Australia-United States Free Trade Agreement that was negotiated in 2004, came into effect in 2005. And of course, the United States wanted to include the PBS in the trade agreement, the Pharmaceutical Benefits Scheme. Of course, we had this farcical thing where the Prime Minister at the time was saying, no, it's not going to be included. Oh, well, it is included. But nothing really much is happening. And the US, of course, wanted to get rid of reference pricing, which was a mechanism of cost-effectiveness analysis, which essentially said that if you have a drug that you're asking to be put onto the PBS as a manufacturer, if you can't establish that it actually has cost-effectiveness, which is better than existing products in a certain class that it's working in, then its price gets referenced down to the lowest price of the drug in the class. There's different ways in which the mechanism works, but that's a sort of overview of reference pricing. So in a sense, it saves the public purse a lot of money. The US doesn't like this because it had a definition of innovation which said that if we come up with something that's new, it's got novel additives, we can stick an advertising campaign on the TV and prove that it's new in the market, then it's innovative. End of story. And we said as Australians, no, we have to prove scientifically that it's innovative. And innovation means not just technical innovation, but the capacity to generate a biologically equivalent drug that works at a lower price. That's innovative too. The fact that you can offer a lower price is a component of innovation. Anyway, so the US set up this trade deal and went through this negotiation. It was clear that we had to give the US reference pricing behind the scenes. In fact, I was asked over by the South Koreans just prior to their trade deal with the US to advise them on how to deal with this, and one of them said, oh, the Australian ambassador here told me that we, the Australians, had to give the US reference pricing. Now, of course, that wasn't what was said in the public. In fact, I had these bizarre conversations subsequently when reference pricing had been shelled out of the PBS. I don't know if you remember that there was legislation passed through in the towards the end of the Howard government. It went through in about 2 weeks. Remember when they had control of both the lower house and the Senate? And Gary Humphreys chaired a committee, Senate committee, looking at it on the Friday, and I gave evidence to it. They looked at it over the weekend, passed the legislation on the Monday. And the whole thing went through both houses of Parliament in 2 weeks and basically fractured the PBS into two categories, an F1 category for patented drugs and an F2 category for generic drugs with no reference pricing. So the US had achieved what it's wanted, essentially. And then I had these conversations with public servants at conferences, and I said, well, the US got what it wanted. Oh, what do you mean? Well, they got reference pricing. No, they didn't get reference pricing. I said, this legislation that was passed in 2007, fracturing the PBS, you know, there's no reference pricing between this. Oh, but that doesn't affect reference pricing. I said, and I went through the whole thing again, and there was just, no, you know, the word was, the poor old public servant had to say, reference pricing is not affected, because obviously there'd been a sort of mandate to come down, you're not allowed to tell the public that reference pricing had been lost. So how did it get lost? You know, what was the mechanism? Obviously these corporations didn't want reference pricing because these pharmaceutical corporations in the US thought it would be more profitable if their drugs, you know, whatever they produce, weren't reference priced down. So what they did was they set up what's called a medicines working group, and this is a common tactic that these corporations use. So a medicines working group involved ostensibly negotiations between the public health officials in Australia and the public health officials in the US, who are supposed to be representatives of the taxpayer. But are they? No, not often, because in the US, these people have what's called a revolving door sort of status. So they're working for Big Pharma 1 year, and the next year they're hired by the government, and then they go back to Big Pharma after they've negotiated what they're supposed to do. So the idea that these public servants are actually representing the public interest is something that looks good on paper, but might necessarily translate to reality. So we wanted to find out what happened in these medicines working groups. Now, you'd think if democracy was working the way it should, this medicines working group would have published minutes so that you could see in detail what was being discussed, what was on the table, because after all, this is what you do with legislation, isn't it? You know, you get it if you want to. You can log on to, or you can go and visit Parliament and you can find out what's being debated. But instead, what you used to get was you get many weeks after the negotiations had taken place, there'd be this one-page summary of, you know, we discussed innovation, ways to promote innovation, you know, about three or four lines, really, was all you got. So we initiated a Freedom of Information Act application about the minutes of this meeting, and, of course, most of it was blacked out, you know, black. But obviously, this is one thing you do find out, is that somewhere in that sort of thing, there's people with conscience, and they always let you get insights into what's going on. So even though everything was blacked out because there'd been an instruction, the person who was compiling it, because they'd obviously been aware that something was funny, had included an op-ed piece that was published in a paper by a conservative politician in the north, who basically said that the way to go forward was to split the PBS into two categories, one that just looked after innovative drugs and one that looked after generic drugs with no reference pricing. So we knew that this had been discussed in the medicines working group, and so we were able to actually come to the hypothesis that this is what had been discussed. The other thing that happened to me is, as a result of getting some research funds from the ARC, we went over to the United States and interviewed some of the negotiators who had been on the pharmaceutical component of the trade deal and who were on the medicines working group. And one of them said, yes, well, I can't really talk about it. You know, I can't really talk about what went on inside the meeting, he said, but I've written it down in some notes, but I can't really show them to you. And I said, oh, well, that's a pity. And they were sitting on the table, you see. And he said, oh, I feel like going to the loo. So he just got up and left the notes sitting there on the table, which, of course, I just turned around and read. And then I turned around and he came back in. And he said, now, what were we talking about? And so you see this over and over again. And so similarly, at another conference, I met one of the Australian negotiators who was on the medicines working group, and I said, you know, this was in the second meeting, I said, you know, did you discuss the proposed F1, F2 changes to the PBS? And she said, oh, yes, we did discuss them, but I can't really tell you anything more. But at least that was an admission that they'd actually discussed the F1, F2 changes. So, of course, then I wrote an article in the Medical Journal of Australia saying, you know, this is what's going on. But you get a lot of flack for that, because the basic line is, no, our public health policy in Australia is not being bartered off. And the large corporations overseas aren't influencing domestic health policy. That it's still controlled by parliamentary representatives and legislation, and that's the line we like to think. But increasingly, that was one example that I've come across, we get this idea that even though we have this idea that at the peak of our legislative arrangements and legal arrangements in Australia, we have a constitution supervised by the High Court, and we have legislation and judges. What I'm increasingly thinking is we have these international trade agreements which are being negotiated by the executive, and in Australia you don't need to get parliamentary approval to sign up to one of these agreements. But because we have a globalised economy where we are very vulnerable to threats of trade sanctions, what's in these trade agreements become very important. Because potentially, if we don't give the US what we agreed to in one of these trade agreements, they can have trade sanctions against us, and they can have what's called cross-retaliation, so that if we don't give them what they wanted in pharmaceuticals, they don't have to give us what we wanted in something else they gave us. I'm not quite sure what they gave us in the free trade deal. They didn't give us lamb, they didn't give us sugar, you know, they didn't give us a whole stack of stuff, but presumably they gave us something. Whatever it is, they can cross-retaliate. So another example of more recent times is tobacco. And some of you are aware of the plain packaging legislation, and that's another quite pertinent example of the way in which these corporations, and they're using a different tactic. So that was one where they used a bilateral trade agreement. And this one they're using what's called an investor-state dispute settlement mechanism. So I'm not sure if you're aware of that, but let's just play it through. So as you know, the current government has decided that it's important to try and reduce the amount of smoking that goes on. There's an enormous amount of research that how damaging it is, particularly in young people. And there's a lot of good research that the actual packaging in terms of the colour of the packet and the placement of the logos is very important in creating the sort of images that young people use when they smoke. And that's why the companies are fighting it, because they know that it's undermining something that does actually help them to do cigarettes. Now, we're not the first jurisdiction to try this. The Canadians tried to get up plain packaging and failed. And one of the reasons they failed is that Philip Morris and these other British Tobacco, other large supranational corporations, said to them, if you try and go ahead with this legislation, we will sue you under an investment treaty, a bilateral investment treaty, and under a particular provision called an investor-state dispute settlement provision. Now, again, these provisions create a sort of supranational governance system that is a bit strange to most of us who are used to thinking about legislation and constitutions. Essentially, what once you've signed one of these investor-state agreements, and that's, again, it's something that the executive, that means the Prime Minister and the Cabinet, can sign without having to get approval from the electorate in any way, then if a corporation feels that its investments have been undermined or impeded by legislation, and in this context, public health legislation in a particular country, then it can sue that government under that treaty before a panel of three trade arbitrators, one of whom's nominated by the company, one of whom's nominated by the government, and the other is sort of, which obviously has the casting vote, is sort of selected by both in this sort of strange way that's a bit difficult to understand. Now, who are these characters, right? I call them jokers, characters. They're investor arbitrators. They're people who think that international law is like a contract. And they look at the terms of the investment treaty, because it's the easiest thing for them to understand, and they say, right, you agree to this. This country has passed this legislation. It's impeding your investment. They have to compensate you. They don't look at international law. They don't look at public health regulations, anything of the WHO. Or they don't take into account... Well, they wouldn't take into account the Framework Convention on Tobacco Control, for example. And so what Australia found now is that Philip Morris is challenging Australia under an investor state clause in a Hong Kong investment treaty. And you might say, well, what's Hong Kong got to do with Philip Morris? Well, Philip Morris has got holding companies in lots of different jurisdictions, and it just so happens that Australia has an investment treaty with Hong Kong. So it's using Hong Kong. In its same dispute over Uruguay, it's using a Swiss-based thing because Uruguay has an investor clause with Switzerland. At the same time, there's this other trade agreement called the Trans-Pacific Partnership Agreement. Well, they call it the Trans-Pacific Partnership because it sounds more friendly and less threatening like an agreement. But actually, this is the United States again trying to influence Australian health policy. And you think, well, you know, we've been through all that. Why on earth are we doing another trade agreement with the United States? It's because the United States wants to get rid of Pharmac in New Zealand, because Pharmac is even more scientific-based in its assessment of innovation of drugs than Australia's PBS. They have closed-bid competitive tenders, for example. It's a fantastic way of finding out what the actual marginal cost of production of a drug is. It's a very good system, and the US has been trying to get rid of that for ages. And one of its tactics was to create this trans-Pacific regulatory agreement where the TGA would basically merge and look after drug regulation in both jurisdictions. And I read this article saying, well, the problem with that is that as a result of the US-Australia Free Trade Agreement, our TGA has inherited all these obligations to warn patent holders when new generic drugs are coming onto the market and to look at innovation in a different way. And the Kiwis would have had to have taken on board all those obligations without getting anything back. So I said, well, there's no point in giving away all your cards at the poker table without getting something back. So the US has basically cooked up this Trans-Pacific Partnership Agreement involving Vietnam, Chile, Malaysia, Brunei, New Zealand, Australia, to push these sort of regulatory changes into domestic markets. Are they going to give us much? I don't think so. And this is the problem with these trade agreements, that you never, when you talk to the negotiators, you say, look, what we want to see is if you trade off something like this about our public health, we want to see what we get back in return. Where's the quid pro quo? And they won't tell you. And so what happens is they have these round of negotiations and the Australian negotiators go off to Washington, they get wined and dined and they all become palsy-wowsy with each other. And the trade ministers always think it's a badge of honour to say, yes, I passed this trade deal, and they hope that something good is in it. And all the time we're actually seeing the erosion. And we're not involved as citizens. We're hoping that these people have our interests at heart, but we don't have any involvement in the process, so except through the sort of pressure that we create by making people aware of it. So Philip Morris wanted to insert one of these investor state dispute settlement clauses in this trade agreement. Now, what would that have meant? Okay, so they haven't got it in yet, so that's why they're relying on the one with Hong Kong. Well, if we look at an example like Canada, which got the same sort of investor state stuff with Article 11 of NAFTA, you know, the North American Free Trade Agreement. Now, there have been numerous cases there where the Canadian government have found, say, for example, toxic additives in gasoline or carcinogenic chemicals, right? And they've said, right, we're going to ban this chemical. We have more than enough evidence to satisfy the precautionary principle that this chemical is going to damage public health, get into the waterways, cause miscarriages, you know, kill young kids, all sorts of stuff. And the US company said, fine, but you're going to have to compensate us, right? That's going to cost $150 million. You're impeding our investment. Yeah, but your investment's killing people. I know, well, it might be, but still, you know, it's an investment. And here's the investor state clause. It doesn't say anything about the fact it's killing people. And this is what Philip Morris is saying with tobacco. We're saying, well, your investment's killing people. And there's a public health exception here. Oh, yes, but that's only in really, really bad cases. You know, we've got a legal product and they run all these sort of arguments. And so this is the difficulty. We then have these three trade negotiators, you know, arbitrators, who don't have a public health background, don't have the intellectual framework in which to understand these sort of things, and also they're being paid by this whole system. They have a vested interest in keeping it going. The last thing they want to do, these arbitrators, is to say, oh, no, there's no way an investor state claim could get up here, because then the whole charade falls down and they never get any more money from these investor state claims, you see, and all the largesse that flows from these people. So they keep producing all these things where they pay out money. And there's been terrible examples where countries like Hungary, for example, were sued under an investor state clause, and because their president didn't want to upset, you know, trade relations because they were trying to get into the EU, they ended up paying $150 million, which was basically the whole health budget for a year, off to some foreign corporation so they wouldn't have the reputation of defaulting on these trade agreements and investor state clauses. So this is the sort of framework in which corporations are influencing health policy all the time. They're lobbying constantly members of parliament here to privatise the healthcare system in Australia. I mean, obviously there are privatised elements, but when you see things like national insurance, for example, the idea is that also, you know, your access to a health system would involve you taking out an insurance contract with a private insurer. Why is this such a bad thing? Well, Switzerland has it, for example. They talk about, well, we've got universal health cover. I said, what do you mean? Well, all our citizens are covered by insurance with the companies. They have to pay, and then the government subsidises the company for the insurance. Well, the problem with this is a model, and the reason why it leads to a doubling of healthcare costs in the US compared to Australia is that every year that this system runs, the insurance companies jack up their price of those premiums, as we've noticed in Australia, when we always have the debate every time the healthcare, they jack them up not just by the inflationary rate, but by a little bit extra to get themselves more profit. So every year there's another 2% on top of the inflation rate, and gradually that creeps up. And that's why the US healthcare system is now costing something like 17 or 18% of GDP, and our healthcare system costs 10% of GDP. So, but these companies see that this is something that is logical to them because it maximises shareholder profit. I remember Michael Moore's film Sicko, if you've watched it, it's a fantastic film about the inequities in the US healthcare system. That film wasn't about people who didn't have health insurance. It was about people who did have health insurance in the US but came up against a healthcare system which found that it was earning more money if it denied those people care. So it could grab their premiums but either limit the amount of care that they were given or not give them care at all. Right? And that's the inequity of sticking an insurer in the middle of your healthcare system. It's always going to have maximisation of shareholder profit as its dominant aim. So, OK, well, I've got 5 minutes. How do we solve all this? Well, there are a few things. One research grant that I've been thinking about this, is to introduce the US False Claims Act in Australia. This is a piece of legislation in the US that rewards whistleblowers with 15 to 35% of the triple damages that are awarded once fraud is proved on the public purse. And the pharmaceutical companies, surprise, surprise, are the main targets. So, for example, one of the biggest verdicts was $2.3 billion against Pfizer for its drug reps going out and encouraging people to prescribe drugs off the recommended indication for the drug. So that's one mechanism. Bring into a system which encourages insiders from the corporate world to reveal information about the fraud that's going on. So I think that's one thing we should do, a False Claims Act. The other thing is get out of these investor state clauses. And one good thing the Gillard government has done is that it has announced that it will no longer sign any more investor state clauses, and it is on the process of getting out of existing. Now, and I think she deserves some credit for that. Right? So that's one of the statements, areas where I think the Gillard government has taken a stand. We said we're sick of these investor state clauses. They have said we are not going to agree to an investor state clause in the Trans-Pacific Partnership Agreement. And I think that's a good direction to go. These They circumvent democratic involvement in public health in particular, and we have to sort of get out of them. It allows for corporate lobbying and pressure on public health officials at a rate that really can't be sustained. So that's something that... Okay, so those are two sort of practical proposals. And of course there are others, like making negotiations on trade agreements more transparent, allowing people to see what's actually negotiated. Phone hacking, yes. Well, it goes into other areas, but I'm focusing on public health. And so there are ways of making sure that, you know, if we do trade negotiations, we get involved as a society a bit more. One more radical proposal that I'd like to sort of end with flows on from this thinking about what I started off with, which is that as a world, we're moving to one where individuals are responding to conscience and corporations don't. And they're holding us back, aren't they, in all sorts of areas. It's the corporations, because they're not responding to this except very indirectly through the conscience of their CEOs gradually. You know, you get this. So what can we do about this? Well, how can we artificially create a conscience in these corporations? Well, you'll see corporations produce, you know, good corporate citizen blurbs and glossy pamphlets, and we're saying we're good corporate citizens, and they'll sponsor sporting clubs and all this sort of stuff. But essentially it leaves them alone to then keep maximising shareholder profit, blah, blah, blah. What we've got to do, I think, is go into the corporations legislation and require corporations to be married. Right? Now, I know there's lots of jokes about same corporation marriage and, you know, who's got a corporation going to marry and all this sort of stuff. But essentially, if you think about human beings, it's not a gender thing. You can marry same sex or you can marry different sex. But the whole thing is that at a certain point in life, when you marry another individual, your interests get merged in a wider whole, don't they? You have to take into account the interests of someone else. And if you have children, you've got an even wider whole, and then the grandchildren. And so you're not just thinking about yourself. You're thinking about a wider network. You're forced to. Now, corporations don't have that as part of their constitutive core. So what we do is require them to get married, not to something it's a bit like a forced Indian type marriage, I know, but you know, this is because they're artificial people. We have to be a bit more controlling. So we say to them, look, you just can't pick, you know, we're going to have a list of sort of projects, a bit like a sort of dating agency, right? These are important public goods that you have to do for this year if you want to get registered. You've got to sign up to put a certain amount of cash and do a certain something on this project or this one, or you can make your pick, but these are the ones we pick, you know, the regulatory agency. And if you do that, you can get registered. If you don't do it, you don't get registered. And then your progress in fulfilling that goal will be publicised, and your shareholders will be made aware of it. And if you fall below, then the shareholders can take action, because if you fall below, there are penalties and all sorts of other problems that you're going to face. And so this is a sort of way of thinking that we're forcing these corporations to actually think of wider good and make them mature as people instead of being these narcissistic individuals running the world. If they're going to be people, they're going to sue for defamation, then they've got to do the other things that people do, like getting married, like having sporting teams. I mean, you could force certain corporations to barrack for the Bombers and Collingwood. That might be a bit hard to force people to barrack for Collingwood. But, you know, other sort of football teams. I'm just joking. So I hope that's given you some insights as to how society is evolving and how we're trying to shape new patterns of governance that are coherent with these underlying physical realities through conscience, how corporations aren't responding to that but have enormous power over particular areas of public health. I've given you a couple of examples, the PBS and the plain packaging of smoking, and I've given you some suggestions about how we can take it forward. So I hope that's been interesting for you.
Thanks very much, Thomas. I just wonder, just as an initial discussion, maybe would someone mind bringing that chair, Paul, forward, and then Thomas can sit here rather than having to stand up? That's great, thanks. I don't know if you followed the recent UN summit on non-communicable diseases, but it seems that the food industry was putting a lot of pressure on the UN to make sure that any declarations from that conference were non-binding and entirely innocuous to those companies. Would you like to make some comments about the food industry and the growing problems of obesity and non-communicable diseases?
Well, look, there have been some excellent talks at this festival about... in fact, Enger, I think, on the first talk on Saturday, basically linked the whole idea of obesity with this wider campaign of corporations to make people eat more. And in fact, he lauded the fat people in society for getting us out of the global economic crisis, because when essentially Kevin Rudd gave $1,000, everybody went out to restaurants and bought food. And you know. So there is this sort of link. And again, the problem with the corporations is they see it as a profit-making exercise. If they can earn lots, and the oil companies too, and the coal companies, they're on a good wicket. The last thing they want is some transformative technology like artificial photosynthesis, which allows each family or community to have its own source of hydrogen fuel by just sticking something on your roof that splits water into hydrogen using sunlight. That's the last thing they'll want right now, unless they can patent it themselves, or they can hold it back like the electric car or do something. What they want to do is they want to keep this paradigm going as long as possible. They know it's petering out. They know that globalisation and this whole thing of digging up rocks in one country and sending to another country and making trinkets and sending them back on big ships is going to peter out. And they know this whole idea that the food that people eat has to be sourced in some other country and put on big ships and then packaged up in little plastic things and given to people, that ultimately people are going to wake up to this and just, you know, it's going to be a taste thing. But at the moment it's earning them a lot of money, so of course this is why we get, you know, we don't want binding influences on this.
Can't we stop them being a person?
Yes, oh, I see. Yeah, well,
I mean, can't we legislate? I think a lot of the antitrust laws around the turn of the 19th to 20th century were sort of around that battle. But why can't we aim for that?
Very hard to sort of wind it back. I mean, I think you've got to be sort of practical. There are good, you know, good things that come from corporations. So you'll see researchers get started, biotech companies, and they get funds for investment, and they can take an idea from a blackboard stage out into the market. There are those sort of positive aspects of corporations. And as someone who's trying to promote global artificial photosynthesis, I know one of the crucial things will be that you have to be large-scale corporate investment. But you want it on certain terms. And if you don't have these corporations with certain, you know, like the capacity of a board of directors not to be sued, you know, if the company goes bankrupt, there's certain sort of things that you'd want. In terms of completely unstitching the whole idea that they are people or can protect their own interests in the law, it's quite complicated because obviously they acquire shareholders' money, they have to be responsible for it, you have to be able to sue them. So how do you sue a corporation if it hasn't got some status under the law? What sort of status do you give it? I mean, you could give it a sort of hybrid status, and maybe that's... Anyway, these are some of the discussions that we could have in terms of corporations.
Okay, what about some questions from you guys? Do you mind speaking into the microphone just so they... Okay.
Just capitalism has been very good.
It's not so much your voice, it's so the radio gets it. It's for recording, so unless you speak into there. Just down there. Sorry, it's just otherwise they won't pick it up for the radio,
I was just making the point that capitalism has been, you know, very good and given a lot of people a better quality of life, and corporations are sort of part of the whole capitalistic program. Why is it now that we all know that greed has taken over enormously in the whole sort of corporation lifestyle, whether it was in the early days of, Unilever taking over? I remember when they came to South Australia about 20 years ago and took over our beloved ice cream factory here in Adelaide. And he was my then father-in-law, got on national television saying how fantastic. And we as a family had the ice cream for about 10 years for nothing because he was the, you know, director of Unilever. But why can't governments rein in capitalism or have some kind of ability to control it, to bring it back to a more acceptable type of conscience that you talked about
Question. Yeah, I think one of the reasons, and that's why I started talking about international trade law, is that it's really out of the hands of governments now. Once you enter into a trade agreement, even if you have the intention...
But they say you get the governments you deserve. Why has it gone out of the hands of governments?
Well, once you've got an international trade agreement, then these companies can, through the trade representatives who they lobby on the other side, can take action against you if they don't like the policies you're developing. So they can ask you to pay large amounts of compensation under investor-state dispute settlement, or they can
they can cross-retaliate under the trade deal, so that because you've got a globalised economy with no tariffs, then they can say, well, we're not going to give you something we agreed to under the trade deal. So all of this is happening at a much greater level, and so they have lobbyists, enormous number of lobbyists in Canberra, constantly aware of policy developments. And if any of those policy developments seem to be anti-corporate interests, then the lobbyists will go up and say, you can't do that because that will affect this trade deal. It'll be contrary to some World Trade Organization agreement, like TRIPS or something else. And so the politicians wind back. Or if the politicians do garner up some courage, like as with the resource rent tax, and try and push something through, which gets a reasonable return back off the corporations have got so much money, like as they're doing now with the carbon tax. You've seen those crazy ads on TV. Oh, why should we do anything? It's someone else's problem. It's not going to affect climate change anyway. You know, and they've got so much money that they're flooding these airways. So that's what you're up against.
Yeah, but we know it's not a fair playing field with corporations. We've known that for years. I mean, why have we taken so long to even... We have to have a revolution.
Yeah. Okay, that's great. Can we come to another question? Thank you.
Do you think in the future, do you see in the future that perhaps people power or the general people's consciousness and could ultimately change some of these rules? And how can we create that? Is it by spreading the word, or what can we do as individuals?
I'm sure it will change. I mean, it's going to change the same way that, you know, one day Mikhail Gorbachev went on TV and said, right, Soviet Union's over.
Right.
And people said, what? Soviet Union? And just went, it's gone.
Gaddafi's
gone, or these things. You think these things are here forever, that the corporate control of global governance is something that's just hardwired into human. The point is it's not. You know, as human beings, we know that there are patterns of symmetry, and we know that these corporations aren't in tune with them. So in time, they will be sloughed off. They will fight, they will resist. It's just like the slave traders. You know, if you throw away our slaves, we're going to have to throw our property into the sea. Remember, that's what Dickens used to say. If you throw away our child labour, we're going to throw our property into the sea. Because they never throw their property into the sea, and they survive anyway. So, look, it's inevitable. And how is it going to be solved? Well, I'm just throwing up some ideas here, but I think the more people feel in their heart that they want to do something, and they say, yes, you know, help. What am I meant to do? You just ask that question of the cosmos. Cosmos will provide the answer to you. I don't know how it works, but that's how it works. I think
there are also organised civil society movements as well. But yeah.
When I knew that this topic was on, I went hunting, and I had believed that Whitlam gave us the pharmaceutical benefit scheme, but of course he didn't. Ben Chifley did. And Ben Chifley saw this country as a place in which you had to invest, and not one that would be subject to others. And I think it wouldn't hurt us to remember that. Mm. And I thank you for what you've been saying.
Mm. Oh, look, if I could just call... Ben Chifley is one of my all-time heroes. I think he didn't just give us the pharmaceutical benefit scheme. He gave us the Commonwealth Bank, the Australian Shipping Line, the ABC, the Australian National, the ANU, yes, the Snowy Mountains scheme. You know, so many things, and he pushed those things through. He had to fight the AMA, well, they were called the British Medical Association then, in two high court cases, and they fought him every step of the way. And even after he got the legislation up, they sent out leaflets to all the doctors in Australia saying, throw Chifley's PBS stuff, you know, formulary in the bin. Then he got a constitutional referendum. A majority of people and a majority of states backed it. And the AMA still took him to the High Court. So when I look at the AMA now, and they all say, oh, you know, we love the PBS, I say, sure. You've always loved it. But, you know, that sort of policy development is very difficult now. Because if Chifley had tried all that stuff now, the pharmaceutical companies would be saying, oh, it's contrary to TRIPS, it's contrary to this trade agreement, you can't do that, you know, we're going to sue you under this trade agreement, all sort of stuff. And then he would have all these people telling him, oh, look at all the consequences, there'll be billions of dollars of compensation you'll have to pay, and all this stuff. This is a different policy space now, you see. So it's going to be, you have to require a different type of leadership. But you're quite right, there's certain people who can push things through.
Good afternoon. Thanks for your speech. You talked about how international human rights law is often ignored, I guess, in these kinds of conversations, and how the investment deals that are struck are so strong. It's, of course, countries that aren't as rich as Australia, the populations in those countries fare much worse under such agreements. So I wonder, we can think about how we change the legal framework in Australia, but internationally I'm wondering, how do we empower maybe those governments and the people in those in not so wealthy countries?
Yeah, well, I had some innovative solutions there. One is that you merge the International United Nations Human Rights Body with the World Trade Organization. You make them into one body, because at the moment the World Trade Organization is over there in Geneva. I don't know if you've sort of visited Geneva, but it's this huge monolithic Stalinist type building down by the lake. Right, basically across the road are all the international human rights buildings, but they might as well be separated, you know, from the Andromeda galaxy and the Milky Way galaxy for the actual, you know, the extent to which they interact with each other. So I've said basically it's time to shut down the WTO, you know, and merge it so that international trade law isn't some anarchic, pro-corporate normative system that just sits outside international human rights. International human rights has this tradition of responding to these idealistic norms. And what I teach my medical students now whenever they have a problem is, if you've got a particular clinical problem, you've got to solve it in terms of ethics, law, and international human rights. And if you don't have one of those, then you fail. Because they all come from different normative traditions. You know, ethics comes out of the Hippocratic tradition, and particularly the Nuremberg Declaration, which said that doctors can't say that what I'm doing was okay because it's supported by the law. This is what the Nazi doctors argued. So there's the system that said, no, medical ethics is actually, for doctors, more important than the law in certain situations. So it's this normative system. Law, there's a lot of legislation. And then international human rights law, which is increasingly a set of idealistic norms that doctors and people in health have to respond to. Now, corporations don't get that. And so when I wrote the book, Who Owns Our Health, part of that was arguing that corporate CEOs should also have a code of ethics. And particularly, you see, at the moment you can be a healthcare CEO, you can be a tyre company CEO one day, and then just move into healthcare. And you don't have to take a code of ethics or anything. You just move into healthcare and you start applying all the stuff you knew in tyre company land to the healthcare system. And you wonder why that they're suddenly coming up with policies which are hurting patients. So I said, we have to start thinking as medical professionals now that if we have a healthcare system that's increasingly run by corporate CEOs, those corporate CEOs should also be brought within our ethical framework, and they should take some aspect of the Hippocratic Oath, that they should make decisions which prioritise patient welfare, not just shareholder interest.
Thanks.
Hi. Something you mentioned which I wasn't aware of was that trade agreements don't have to be voted on or approved by our country's parliament. Would that be a way to remedy the situations, to change whatever needs to be changed, to make sure that our representatives get to vote on these agreements before they get put into action?
It could be, but you probably need a constitutional referendum to do that. In the United States, the Senate has to vote on trade agreements. That's why you often see these bizarre things in the United States where they have these unilateral interpretive declarations. So the US negotiators enter into a trade deal and negotiate it. Then it hits the US Senate, and the US Senate says, we can't agree to this, and this, and this. And so they put on a unilateral interpretive declaration, basically undermining what was agreed. Now, it's great for them, because it means that they only have to agree with exactly what they want. But we don't have that process, and essentially the executive can just enter into a trade deal. Where the trade deal requires changes to legislation, like where, for example, the free trade deal required changes to our Therapeutic Goods Act, usually the trade negotiators will require that legislation to be passed through before the trade deal comes into force, because to make sure that it actually happens. And that's how we did manage to create some balance in the healthcare provisions, because we added the anti-evergreening amendments, the legislative changes to the TGA Act. So there are things we can do. If public is aware of that, they can say, look, you know, we want some protective legislation. And then there is a status for that under the trade agreements, because you can say that legislation sets up our legitimate expectation under the trade deal, and then if we want to protect ourselves, we can. Our negotiators have got something to argue. Okay. So that's an intermediary step.
So if we could bring it back into the parliament, people.
Yeah, if we said, look, this is so important, there has to be sort of legislation passing it. It could be a convention.
And everything would be public then too.
Yeah, it could be all public, yeah. But it wouldn't be binding, and if a government didn't want to do it, it could just go ahead and sign it.
One question strikes me is that you're putting the emphasis on the corporations, but a lot of this is to do with a failure of capitalism in a way that Marx predicted about the importance of the ownership of the means of production. And it seems to me that, you know, we can't really deal with this just seeing it as the corporations. It's actually about a political system that puts the maximisation of profit at the heart of enterprises rather than people's needs.
Mm. Yes, I'm aware of that. Somehow I'm just not motivated by the capitalist, anti-capitalist dialogue. I guess it's all been hacked over, and the camps there are well established, but I don't know in the sort of merging of socialist and capitalist ideology and the collapse of communism, you've really got this melange in the middle. I mean, what do you call the Chinese system? I mean, it's nominally communist, but it's really capitalist. I think once you get, my sort of feeling is once you get caught up in that, you risk going back to a dialogue that's sort of burnt out some time back. And really what we should be, and so increasingly what I find is, and I can pick up your point, which is right, but I think there's no need to get caught up in that terminology. So that I talk about corporations in preference to capitalism because it's not so much about the capacity of individual human beings to earn profit and use technology to do it, or even to create entities that allow them to get money to help them develop things as individual human beings. You know, if you write a book, then you should be able to get copyright over it and protect, you know, all the work you've done. It's really about the fact that some of these artificial people, the corporations, are taking the whole thing too far. So that's why I guess I prefer to see the corporation as an entity as more of a problem than the ideology of capitalism.
Is Australia doing its best to protect its interests in these trade negotiations? For example, do we pick the best or brightest negotiators to protect Australia's interest? And
is there anyone from DFAT in the room?
And one example.
Is it going out on the radio?
It's on the radio.
There was an act. I think there was one trade agreement put into an Act of Parliament where it was to run for 40 years and then roll over, unless you gave 40 years notice of withdrawal from the Act.
Right. Well, look, how can I start? Look, the trade negotiators that we have, and I've met them and worked with them, I think they try and do their best. There are some problems, and it's not problems of their own personal failings. Is that we have this system where every time we have a trade deal, we have a new set of trade negotiators. So that there's not this sort of memory of, the bastards tried this last time, they're not going to get it this time. So there's that problem. Then there's the problem that the trade negotiators are hamstrung by the fact that at the end of the day, the trade minister wants to sign off on a trade deal. It's like, you know, put a stamp on your door, you know, delivered trade deal. Even if it's a useless trade deal, they want to do it because it's something they can stick down on their portfolio, negotiated trade deal. And then they'll try enormously hard to find something good about the trade deal because, you know, it's more important to, you know, for our strategic relationship with the United States. You keep hearing that in the background, which really means, translated means, they're screwing us like hell, but, you know, we need their nuclear bombs, you know, to keep the hordes at bay, or something like this is going on in the background. So that's a problem. But I think there is another problem, which is, and this is more a tactic thing. The United States corporate sector and the trade negotiators through the US Trade Representative worked very closely for years prior to each trade deal on these committees called IFAC committees, Industry Functional Advisory Committees. And they trawled through all the things that would be useful for their corporations to see in foreign countries, you know, for its changes. And then they come to the trade negotiator with a whole set of proposals in written form. We don't do that as systematically. And I've said to our negotiators who said, you know, what are we going to do in this deal? And they said, oh, we're going to stop the US doing this. And I said, well, that's all defensive. I said, what changes are we going to get in the US? Are we going to fast-track biologics? Are we going to encourage more cost-effectiveness analysis in the US? Are we going to allow, springboarding of generics in the same way that they do in the US? You know, at least even give us parity, you know, like have some positive proposals of changes we want in the US. And we never see those things on the table. So there's a sort of inferiority complex we have as negotiators, that we're this tiny country, we can't say, and it's annoys, and I've said this in the Senate committee on the first trade deal, We really don't deserve to be a republic. We haven't got anything to say. If we hit these trade deals and we haven't got anything, you know, proactively that we're putting out to the world as something we stand for, then the whole Republican debate becomes a sort of window dressing thing that really doesn't motivate you at all. I mean, it's not really until we stand up to large interests internationally and say, look, we stand for a certain set of values and we're prepared to. And that's why I think the Gillard government deserves some credit for saying that it's going to pull out of the investor-state dispute settlement thing, because that's a stance that no one else is taking, and we're taking it, and I think, thank goodness. And once someone's done something like that, they deserve a pat on the back, and so that's what I'm doing by saying.
But what about Australia's role in the PACER Plus, where we're trying to do over the Pacific Islands?
Yes.
I mean, I don't. I'm a member of the People's Health Movement, and we're working with colleagues in the Pacific Islands, and we're really getting.
And the anti-counterfeiting.
Yeah, I mean, and basically Australia is playing the role in the Pacific that the US has played with Australia, haven't they?
You're absolutely right. Yeah. And what can you say except that that doesn't deserve a pat on the back.
Yeah, a big not. The other question, I thought that in the People's Health Movement, one of the things we're proposing is that in all trade negotiations, Ministry of Health should have a strong voice, and that ministries of health in each country should be kind of upskilled to be able to look at health impact assessments of these trade treaties. Do you think that might work?
Well, possibly, except we have I'm not sure that our Ministry of Health has functioned as well as it could.
No, but in an ideal world, if they were given the skills, could it be a way?
Yeah, if we had the right type of people in our Ministry of Health who had this thing. But I think one of the worst things we had that I found out in the set of interviews that we had about the PBS was that almost as soon as the trade deal with the US was passed, there was a meeting of the Pharmaceutical Benefits Advisory Committee looking at whether Lipitor or atorvastatin should be given a price premium.
Mm-hmm.
And all the interviews we had, and we did interviews with all the members of the PBAC, most of them said we were really on the borderline about whether we should give this price premium. But we received a lot of pressure from the Department of Health that the US wanted it, they'd been promised it, and they had to give it. Now, if we look at our PBS expenditure, Lipitor per year is $500 million. It's way ahead of anything else, right? $500 million per year, because it has to be taken every single day to the end of your life. And there's a lot of evidence now that it's not much better than simvastatin, which is half the price. It lowers HDLs, but it lowers LDLs, but it also lowers HDLs, whereas simvastatin lowers LDLs and keeps your HDLs high. So one way in which public physicians and things could actually help the PBS is to stop prescribing atorvastatin and start prescribing simvastatin. And they've recommended this in a whole series of publications overseas. But that's an example of where a particular corporation, which was Pfizer, wanted a particular outcome, and at least as far as I've been able to determine, exerted pressure through our Department of Health to get a particular outcome. Now, if you trace all that, people will say, no, it never happened like that, he's making it up, you know, this is typical, he's like this, you know, he's a bit of a fire, you know, forget what he says, you know, I've heard all this before. But as far as I can see, that's what happened. And it's important that the public know, because if the public doesn't know, nothing's going to change.
Okay, we've got time for a few more questions.
I wonder if I could go back to something that was talked about earlier. Do you think corporations are pro or anti-market in their structure? Do corporations have a strong interest in subverting market forces rather than promoting them? And is there any role for market forces rather than corporate forces in some of the things that you're discussing?
Well, I have this debate a lot. Corporations' view of market forces is a monopolistic, collusive view of market forces. It's something that they can manipulate, and the strong people figure out how to get monopolies. Woolworths, you know, gets into the food market, right? It drives down price, $1 for a thing of milk. Completely unsustainable, but what they do is that they push all the other smaller competitors out of the market. Once all the other smaller competitors are gone, then the price goes back up to $1.50 or $2, right? So this is the power of monopolies, and they're always looking for this angle. And that's why we have to figure out regulatory ways of making sure that we have strong antitrust and anti-monopoly regulations. Then markets work, but we need regulators that are much stronger than we have. We have a very under-regulated corporate sector in Australia. And I think one of the ways we have to beef it up is this false claims legislation. Obama is sticking it into everything. His Wall Street reforms, his new healthcare package, even the tobacco legislation now he's got in over there. They're all sort of set up to require, to allow corporate insiders to come out with crucial information that will reveal whether markets are being distorted, and then regulators can take it up. But in Australia, what happens is we expect whistleblowers to go to the ACCC without the protection of a private lawyer, provide all this information for nothing, and then the ACCC will figure out what to do. In the US, if you're an insider, you go to a private lawyer who protects your interests. The private lawyer packages up that information that you have, takes it to the Department of Justice. If the Department of Justice likes it, they work in tandem with the private lawyer to run this case through, and then the whistleblower and the firm that represented them get up to 35%. Now, if you have a verdict of $2.3 billion, 35% is a lot of money. So that's a big incentive for insiders to come out of the private sector, particularly ones who may be facing in a volatile employment market, you know, losing their job anyway. And so you start to get information about what's actually happening. Now, if we had the system here, we'd find out about, you know, the oil companies that jack up the prices on the weekend for petrol. We know there's collusion going on. It's not a free market. But until we can get an insider to come out who reveals how they're talking to each other, we can't do anything about them.
All right, well, I think we're nearing our end. Are there any final comments you'd like to make?
Oh, thanks for coming.
Yeah. Okay, well, I think that was a really inspiring talk, and it certainly warned us about the dangers of corporations and gave some ideas of how we should be lobbying our politicians. So go home and write a letter to your local member about the need for false claim legislation and asking them to do better trade treaties. Thank you, everybody.
This session from the Adelaide Festival of Ideas 2011 was recorded by Radio Adelaide through the support of the Bar Smith Library, University of Adelaide, the University of South Australia Library, and Flinders University Library.